reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turn. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a special edition of In the Gravel Trap. It is our Rolex 24 recap. I'm your host, Adam Tate of Tribute Racing. I am joined this evening by Josh Farmer of Motorsport Monday and Christopher DeHardy of Motorsport.com. It's only going to be an hour show for you guys tonight. Mostly we are going to look back at this weekend's Rolex 24 at Daytona. Mr. Farmer was at the event for Motorsport Monday, so Josh, I'm going to hand it over to you and just give us your impressions of the race weekend from how the teams were doing, how the fans were, the atmosphere. I heard it was a record crowd. Did it look like one?
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, right before the race, I went out to the pit road for to watch some driver intros, and it was it was like a cattle drive trying to get in there. I mean, there was a huge crowd. I mean, there was a lot of interest and a lot of the fans in the garage before the race. You could tell they weren't just your average casual fan. They were pretty passionate and they were interested in all the different kinds of cars. There was a lot of interest, especially on the pole sitting car from Mike Shank with the new Ligier and then the revised Delta Wing. But then on the race side, the race was easily one of the best Rolex 24s we've seen. I mean, there was just there was a lot of good drama in all four classes. I mean the prototypes, the battle between Wayne Taylor Racing and Chip Ganassi Racing at the end, and then that until the Taylors made a rare mistake and miscalculated how long they were in the car. Other than that, they drove such a perfect race. Ganassi being Ganassi, they don't make mistakes. Their cars usually don't break. I mean, well, in this case, the 01 car broke right at the end, but the 02 car, I was really happy for them, and Jamie McMurray, the emotion of, like, you could see on that last lap, he was really getting emotional, and then in the media center he was really emotional, and then onto GTLM, since they were the next highest finishing class. I mean, that immediately from the start with the two Corvettes and the Aston Martin and the of course the Ferrari, going three wide through the trial. And then with each car going through the road course section, and each car had its own advantage, and then it seemed like every car had their the number three Corvette was the only one to really not have issues. I mean, four car of Milner, Pagenaud, and Oliver Gavin. I mean, they were quick, but then they kept on. But then it's like they kept on having problems. But then as the sun went down, the Porsches came to life. But then both factory Porsches got taken out in the same accident. And then from there the Falcon Tire Porsche, Patrick Long was driving it, had the electrical wiring fried. And then the remaining cars, the pro drive Aston broke, and then the Ricci Ferrari had an electrical failure, and then one of the Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan BMWs had problems, and then it's pretty much the GTLM was just a race of survival, and then the last dash to the finish there. I mean, Jan Magnussen held him off, and or he held the 25 off and took an easy win, and then in prototype challenge the attrition was worse with only two or three cars ended up finishing, and Core Autosport ended up leading much of the race despite their problems, and then with 20 minutes to go Colin got hit by a prototype and then got back on the track, and then going to the bus stop the thing just broke and smashed into the wall, and then the PR1 Matheson Motorsports just they pretty much just ran a conservative race and was settling in for a second place finish and ended up taking a shocking win, and for Andrew Novich win on debut, and then Tom Kimber-Smith, he's kind of had an underappreciated career. He has a couple of class wins at Le Mans, and he runs occasionally in PC over here. For him to take a win was good, mm-hmm. and then in GC Daytona, it was from top to bottom. That class was just nuts, and I said in last week's show about the Buckler Aston Martin being quick. They were quick, but then they got taken out by the F course Ferrari stuff on track. Yeah. But then it was the final 6 hours with the fight between the Australian V8 supercar standout Shane van Gisbergen and Kuno Whitmer, that Viper just had sheer power on the oval, but then the WeatherTech Alex Job Porsche was just really good through the road course, and then once Whitmer was able to get far enough ahead, they were able to build up a. He was able to build up a big lead, then he just handed it over to Dominic Farnbacher to finish the job, and that's what they get. But I have to give a big shout out to the team's pro am driver Ben Keating. He won the Austin race we were all at. But here's a guy got into racing just as a hobby because he sells cars in Texas, and he's moved on from racing in the spec Dodge Viper Cup and then he moved on to the GTC and American Challenge where he was racing a Porsche, and then he pretty much summed up in the media center. It was really special to win the Rolex 24 in a car that I sell, and a real prime case of the old days of racing of when it was win on Sunday, sell on Monday, and it's true case in sports car racing. So, all in all, it was one of the craziest Rolexes ever, and I'm glad I got to be a part of it. So what are your thoughts, yeah, starting with Adam?
I'm glad you got to be a part of it. It was a crazy Rolex. I didn't enjoy it quite as much as last year, but there were storylines in every category, and all the others. But I want to hear your thoughts on this one first, because the main thing this year's Rolex 24 is going to be known for is the showdown that never was. The late caution comes out because Colin Braun and the Colorado Sport PC car smacks the wall and catches on fire, and everybody was rubbing their hands because the Taylor car, they were right on Scott Dixon, and you just knew that Taylor was going to go for it. And they call him into the pits because they miscalculated the driver time. I don't know if Wayne Taylor Racing is destined to always be a bridesmaid and never a bride. I mean, the last 3 years they've finished second and third and third. Or is it 2 seconds and a third? Either way, they've been on the podium, always knocking on the door. And it seems that Action Express or Ganassi or somebody always gets the better of them. What are your thoughts on that part, Josh?
Well, I think with racing it takes being lucky and good, and this time they made a simple mistake. It could have been fixed on the last pit stop. They could have put either Ricky or or Max Angelelli in the car, and you know, but still, like they were saying, they had Jordan in the car because he's better at conserving fuel. So you know, it's about putting your best foot forward there. I mean, I guess in hindsight, you know, if I were Wayne, Max Angelelli didn't get his nickname Max the Axe for nothing. If they would have put Max in the car for that for the final stint on the lap, if they would have changed drivers on their second to last pit stop, you know, I think Max may have been able to maybe make a better charge at Dixon than Taylor was able to. But I mean, it just eventually came down to the Ford EcoBoost engine in the back of Ganassi's Riley just ended up it makes more torque coming out of that. So Chris, what are your thoughts?
For me, the big takeaway I have is that the P2s was very unreliable on the Daytona track. Probably didn't do as much testing as what they should have. I was really impressed by the IndyCar contingent that was there, and Jamie McMurray's reaction to him being in a class with AJ Foyt and Mario Andretti being the only three drivers to win the Daytona 24, the Daytona 500, and the Rolex 24. I also didn't like how the GTLM cars had very little reliability except for the Corvettes. Corvette would have finished 1-2 if the Ford car wouldn't have had so much bad luck. But then again, it's a 24-hour race. Who knows what can happen? I have to say that I love, you know, the nighttime atmosphere at Daytona. I mean, I experienced it once back in 2013, or what I could in 2013, but it was a lot of fun to watch on the stream online. Adam?
I just want to, if we can go over our favorite and least favorite parts of the race, I'll kick that off with some of my favorites. My very favorite was probably GTD. When Bill Riley and all the Viper crew with Viper Exchange and Riley Motorsports have been able to put to do with that team, with that car, after Fiat Chrysler axed the factory program in GTLM, to come back with those guys and get such a resounding victory. I mean, was it close with Alex Job at the end? Yes. But this is a car, mind you, that was sent to the back of the field for the penalty and qualifying, and they came all the way through, won the class resoundingly. I could not be happier for those guys. Also really happy to see Mazda making a lot of progress with this guy, Active Diesel. They both retired again, but James Hinchcliffe was very upbeat. He said the car is faster, it handles better, it brakes better. He said it is so much better than it used to be. And they really improved it. You know, they're sticking by this car. And they led some laps. Legitimately led laps, not on into the race. So progress there, always good to see. I loved how close the battle in GTLM was with the BMW with the Corvette at the end. I think most people knew the Corvette was going to take it. But it was nice. And overall, my biggest disappointments were just some of the boneheaded things, the Aston Martin-Ferrari collision. I think people will talk about that one for quite a long time and scratch their heads. The Delta Wing going out early with gearbox issues yet again when it's really finally showing some good pace. And really the reliability of the P2 cars. You know, everybody's brand new with them, especially HPD and Mike Shanks moving to that gorgeous Ligier, which set the quickest time in all the practice sessions in qualifying and in the race. But, you know, you smack a tire barrier and go behind the wall to fix it, and then you have a suspension piece fail later from said damage, you know, you're never going to win. And Chrome broke too, as Josh just pointed out to me. But I think it shows a lot of potential, so I'm going to turn the negative into a positive. I'll be really curious to see how they go next time at Sebring. And I fully expect Crone and Mike Shank and ESM to pull in some race wins. I just think they were up against it. They had teething issues. And you look at the Daytona prototypes, even though they've been modified a bit since the merger and the BOP and everything, that's still a tried and true program, and it's really solid. And the teams have a ton of experience with those cars. But give it some time. I think by season's end, it'll be a really close championship. And I can't say if the GP car, B2 car is going to win it. Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to agree with you that I think the best, you know, I mean, it actually it's kind of hard to nail down what was a good class because I mean every class, like I said earlier, every class had its drama. I mean the Corvette and the Aston were going three wide right at the start, but in GTD there were battles all throughout. I mean GTD is easily one of the most, or probably the most competitive class in the Tudor Championship right now. I mean, there's so many different cars. I mean, there's Aston, there's Vipers, there's Audis, there's Porsches, there's BMWs, you know, and then the battle with with Whitmer and the Alex Job Porsche. I mean, that was, you know, that was exciting as hell. I think the negative part, like you guys said, I mean the bonehead move with the of course the Ferrari right in front of the 007. I mean, that was, you know, that didn't need to happen, you know, and then with all the LMP2s breaking, you know, and none of the Daytona prototypes breaking, but then again, to be devil's advocate there, you know, the new ARX HPD prototype, you know, it is very new, and there's probably still some reliability issues. I mean, debuting a car in a 24-hour race, you know, right, exactly, and then, like you said, I mean, Adam, I know you're a Mazda Miata fanatic, but seeing the one speed source Mazda briefly taking the lead and how so much progress they have done in a short amount of time and using their manufacturer relevant SkyActiv technology was really cool. And I also got to give a shout out to BAR1 Motorsports with a very colorful SpongeBob SquarePants livery, courtesy of driver Tommy.
Oh,
Christie, who works for a yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's from driver Tommy Driesby, who works for an advertising agency in Hollywood that designs movie advertisements. Whenever Tommy races, he usually has a movie on his car. But I got to give a shout out to them because it's just kind of going back last year to Sebring when Gaston Kirby probably the worst move to get back on the track and ended up taking PC leader Alex Tagliani out. You know, that was a worse move than Milkaduno, if you can believe that. But I mean this year they were quick. You know, Johnny Mullen put the car on pole and they led a lot of the start, but then they got spun out, and then like everyone else in PC, they had their problems, but they ended up finishing in second, only one lap off the class lead. So a lot of kudos to them. And I think with Johnny Mullen back with them, I mean, Johnny's won championships abroad, and you know he's a proven talent. So I think that team's going to get better and better. You know, I mean it's kind of hard to beat Core Autosport. Core's really one of the only real well-funded PC team, and plus they're getting a lot. They get their, I mean, they also run the GTL and Porsche team, so there's a lot of financial support there, but yeah, I think the other one's gonna get better. Chris,
my favorite part of the start was the beginning of the race. Honestly, I loved the very big GT battle that they had with the two Corvettes and the Porsche and the Aston Martin. I was kind of shocked that the Shank car did not leave the opening stint, despite having the fastest car in practice. I guess Ganassi guys just wanted it more. I definitely like the nighttime scene as well because you never know what can happen at the night. But that being said, I only wish that we could have had some better reliability from the P2 cars because it would have been great to see how well Krone could have done. My least favorite part, I mean, I have to agree with you, Josh, with how many boneheaded moves there were. I know I drove in the 24 hours of Daytona iRacing event that they had on the 17th where it was like a test race, and there were a lot of questionable moves there as well. It's a shame that, you know, the same thing happened here. But then again, being a 24-hour race, you never know what can happen. Another thing I didn't like was how the Core Autosport car went out with 20 minutes to go in a blaze of glory, you could say. It was just a bad ending for them with Colin Braun almost winning that race. I mean, winning that class, I should say. But, I mean, hey, it's another one in the books, and it was fantastic that we got another new winner with McMurray and Kyle Larson in there. And I kind of wish Shane Van Gisbergen could have had a win over the Rolex because it would be great to see some more Australians competing in the race as well. Adam?
Agreed. And don't forget TK, Funkinan. That is actually his first Rolex 24 win as well. So guy is entering in the – no, that's his first. It was
really?
Dixon's second. But, yeah, it was Kanan's first. So
yeah,
he joins rarefied era of Indy 500, Rolex 24, and IndyCar Championship. yeah, I think it's a shame there wasn't some more reliability. But boneheaded moves happen in a 24-hour race. There is so much fatigue that sets in for the drivers, the crews, the team principals, the media, the fans. You know, it's exhausting, but that's the appeal of it to me. And the night racing is so good. And, Josh, you seem pretty urgent to chime in. You forgot something?
And I also want to say I was really impressed with Sage Karam. You know, I mean, Sage, well, once again, you know, I mean, sports car racing, he's strictly been a single-seater guy, but, you know, he made a lot of great passes for the win on the outside and driving through traffic, and you can tell this kid, he wants to ride in IndyCar so badly. You know, when we talked to him in the media center, he said, you know, I'm giving it my all here and pushing, pushing forward. And I mean, I know Sage has kind of been labeled for being a little cocky, but you know, the kid's 18 years old, but he seems a lot more mature this year. And I think if Chip was to put him in the fourth Indy car, you know, I think he would, you know, I think, I see success right around the corner for him.
That's a good point, and it's good you said it. For those of you listeners who don't know, Frank Santoroski from Drafting the Circuit is often on our show with us, and he never misses a chance to put in a plug for Sage Karam. So glad Josh got that in. You know, it was a good race. For me, what do y'all want to see or expect to see going forward, though, into Sebring? They've got a good couple months until everybody goes down to Florida to run for 12 hours, which many famously say are as hard as running 24 anywhere else. Are y'all looking for more of the same? Do you expect the P2 cars to strike back? What are you hoping for, Chris?
I'm hoping for more reliability from the P2 cars because I like seeing the DPs and the P2s battle each other closely. I'd also like to see a greater variety of cars at the front of the GT class. I just hope that we can have some better reliability from the Ferraris and, of course, the Falcon Porsche. I love seeing that car win because it's great to see a team, you know, go and do their own thing and win. I'd also like to see less officiating errors, like how, you know, they had all this caution stuff last year and how they missed the Porsche penalty with, I think it was the Porsches and GTD and GTLM. They couldn't even tell the difference between the two. It was just very, very odd last year. Josh?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I mean, this year, I mean, I was talking to Tony DeZino about it, that you know this year everything, I mean, IMSA didn't drop the ball like they did last year. I mean, last year there was a bunch of fanfare heading into the race, the first race of the Unified Championship, and you know, and of course, you know, we had Memo Gidley's horrific crash that you know anytime you see a crash that horrific, you know, it takes your breath away. But then the weird officiating call with the battle for the win in GTD, you know, they initially flagged down the level 5 Ferrari for aggressive driving, but then the flying lizard car went to victory lane. They took all the press shots, and then they changed their mind an hour later and said, you know what, level 5 didn't do anything wrong, and then that subsequently led to Scott Tucker just pulling the plug on the whole program and selling the car to someone else. But yeah, I mean, heading into Sebring, I think Sebring is a track a little bit more suited to the P2 cars. I mean, last year, had it not been for that last caution, you know, ESM would have won it. And I think with a year under IMSA's belt to kind of get everything settled out. I mean, I think they're still learning, you know, with the two sides together, but I think they're trying to get it right. So, and obviously with some of the bonehead moves, I mean, you know, they're going to happen no matter what. But you know, I mean, Sebring is a lot tougher race than Daytona. The track's rougher, the conditions are going to be different. So I'm looking forward to it, and I wish I was going. Adam?
Yeah, I'll echo that sentiment. Especially what Chris said. He said he liked seeing the DP cars and the P2 cars run together. That was a big part of the controversy, you know, this time a year ago, and putting the classes together, especially when the DPs just mauled everyone at Rolex last year. But I like seeing them together, too. It has a variety that, you know, no other series in the world has. WEC has the P1 cars, and they're very, very impressive. But seeing the DPs with their old-school technology, you know, last EcoBoost Ford, I know they're pushing like crazy. But, and then seeing the P2 cars with their more, you know, modern take on it, it's refreshing. I really enjoy it. P2 cars may very well strike back at Sebring. I think it will be a very, very good race. You had one more closing thought there on Rolex, Josh?
Yeah, well, I kind of wanted to have a little bit of an opinion on the DPs. I mean, it was like, you know, for a while, I mean, the current gen DP car, I mean, other than the Riley, that's essentially, you know, it's essentially a 10-year old car, but the Corvette prototype, you know, they look good. I mean, because that's one thing about the Daytona prototypes when they first came out, that you know some of the designs, I mean, it wasn't the ugliest thing I've ever seen, but it's just the cars, they looked like something out of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and then they were rather slow. I think that's kind of, you know, some, you know, from a purist perspective, they had to crank a lot of extra power into the DPs heading into last year. And I mean, in fact, you know, the Pirelli World Challenge cars were quicker than the Daytona prototypes, and even the first year they implemented them, the GT car set the fastest lap in qualifying, but they changed the rules so that if I recall correctly, maybe Chris can remember this, but it was like an 03, a GT car set the fastest lap, but they wanted the Daytona prototype to start up front, so they just moved them to the front to make them look prettier. But I do agree that it's like I do agree with what you said of how it's, you know, having this unique spin of, you know, old school two frame car going against a state of the art prototype like the Ligier or the ARX. you know, and plus it's just, you know, in America, we've always been different, you know. I mean, Europe has the LMP1 versus LMP2. We have DPs versus LMP2. So,
it was 2003 when they had the DP start the top 10. In fact, I actually have the results right here in front of me, where TRG won with a Porsche. They had a 9-lap lead over Rizzi Competizione and a Ferrari. And then the GT car finished third with another Porsche for Remworks. And then the first DP was in fourth place overall. And they were about 16 laps down.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes, I mean that just shows. I mean, I guess, you know, early days, kind of like what we talked about, you know, with the new Honda prototype, baptism by fire, but and reliability. But it's just, you know, it just goes to show you how, you know, how slow the old DPs really were. If a GP car was able, you know, was able to you know, not only win by 9 laps over a fellow GP car, but, you know, but for the Daytona prototype to be that far behind.
Yes, and that was an interesting time in racing when that all got started, because you had a few-year time span. You had a GT Viper, a GT Corvette, and a GT Porsche all win overall at the Rolex 24, which nowadays would be impossible. I guess it just shows really how far the DPs have come. Aerodynamically, stylistically, and in terms of performance, and fixing the P2 cars in is great. And you hit on a great, great point that I don't think people talk enough about or realize, in the difference between America and races in Europe. And Europe is far more often a manufacturer-based thing. And the manufacturers go out and they compete in F1. Or they go out and they build LMP1 level prototypes, or back in the day, which is the World Sports Car Championship, or Group C. America, it's much more of a privateer thing, and you've got guys just for the love of racing going out and building that sports car, that prototype here, or that Indy car. And a lot of people go, LMP1 car is faster. Like, oh, an F1 car is faster. But, you know, more often than not, the past few years, the better, the more exciting racing is very often on our side of the pond. So I feel really lucky for that. And I actually enjoy that distinction. It's just that much more variety in series that are similar, yet profoundly different at the same time. Do you guys have a thought on that one?
I'm going to let Josh take it.
Oh, you can go ahead on. Well, actually, I do have a point on, like, talked about, you know, it doesn't really matter what the car is, as long as the racing is good. You know, I mean, me, I'm a purist. I don't like to see things manipulated. So it's like, you know, Yeah, I mean, I echo your thoughts. I mean, it's not necessarily bad that we have, you know, old school Daytona prototypes. It's just different, you know, yeah. And you know, every race is different. You know, every track is different. You know, and that's, you know, I mean, it kind of, you know, brings up about like, you know, like Formula One. I remember Peter Windsor was saying, you know, if you want to watch a million pointless passes, you know, go watch IRL or NASCAR or something. And it's like, you know, F1, you know, he was like, don't really see a problem with F1 of, you know, you see a guy beat the second place car in the first corner, then throughout great strategy ends up winning. It's just, you know, every series is different, has its own spin. I mean, F1's not necessarily all about passing cars on the track. It's about, you know, teamwork, car design, engineering, and driving, where it's like, you know, you have IndyCar, which, you know, it's pretty much you're given what you got, but it puts on some of the best racing we've ever seen, and, you know, and NASCAR is a good point too.
Yep, and along those lines, I want to transition away from Rolex and look at IndyCar, specifically the Monza Red Indy. I know, Chris, that is very near and dear to your heart. I wanted to tell everybody what's coming up as far as that's concerned.
Well, so today they actually, and yesterday they actually had some tests over at Homestead Miami Speedway. Earlier today they had testing on the road course there, and they're going to be doing the oval in a couple of days, or I think tomorrow actually they're going to do the oval. But earlier today they had 12 cars that competed in the later session. The earlier session there were only 11. But Spencer Pigot led the first session. Scott Hugger was second, and Jack Harvey was third. In the second session, Ed Jones, who is driving for Carlin Motorsports, he actually got the fastest time in the second session. Kyle Kaiser was second. Shelby Blackstock was third. There's been a few other announcements recently regarding the Maserati Indy. Starting off in USF 2000, Victor Franzoni is going to be back with Afterburner Autosport. Team Pelfrey announced their USF 2000 lineup. In fact, one of the guys competing in there was at NOLA Motorsports Park testing. John Comiskey Racing in USF 2000 announced Anthony Martin will be joining them. And I met him over at NOLA about a month or two ago when he was testing over there. And in Indy Lights, Juan Piedrahita, who drove last year for, I think it was Team Moore, he's going to be driving again in Indy Lights this year, but he's going to be joining Bellardi Autosport. And the big, hire for Carlin, Max Chilton, he actually drove the sixth fastest time in the first session and the fifth fastest time in the second. So he's looking to be pretty competitive this year for Carlin, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do. And looking forward to seeing if Scott Hargrove can get a spot at A-Star Motorsports confirmed for next year. I'm looking forward to seeing that team, and especially looking forward to seeing how Pigot and Hargrove continue their battle from Mazda last year into Indy Lights this year. Adam?
Of all the things with Monster Road to Indy, the two things that stick out to me are A-Star. I really want to see how that team shapes up. I think they could really be possibly the team to beat for Indy Lights, and their livery on that one our aisle 15 looks really, really, really good. And then with Carlin, I'm really curious to see how Chilton gets on. I think really well. I mean, he's automatically jumping into the car, and it's way down on power for what he's used to over the past several years. So I think it'd be good to develop them, and really, really curious to see how they figure him into that team's future. Along those lines, really, really impressed with how many IndyCar drivers were in Rolex this past weekend. And looking ahead to the IndyCar season, we don't have any new information on aero kits, but with the aero kits coming in on IndyCar, yet again, more IndyCar drivers being in the winning team at Rolex. And also, all this happening in the Mazda Road Indy, I'm looking forward to IndyCar perhaps more than I ever have been before. How about you guys? Josh?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've got, despite the schedule being abbreviated, and we still are, IndyCar is still kind of fighting for its life with their TV deal. I mean, I do think, you know, we have the potential for greatness with the aero kits, but where my concern is after talking with some people at Chevy and Honda at Daytona that, you know, they submitted the homologation or they submitted the plan for homologation last week, and teams are supposed to take delivery of their aero kits at I believe it's April 1st or the end of March, because the race in Brasilia is going to be run with the 2012 body kit. So that leaves us that leaves Honda and Chevy just a little more than a month and a half to build all the parts for 22 cars. And they're just building bodywork, but for everything to get put together and not have any manufacturing flaws, that's going to take a lot of work. And from talking to Chevy's PR rep Judy Dominic and T. McHale and Dan Layton from HPD, you know, they're both, you know, it's crunch time for them to get things get things together. You know, I mean, I would just hate to see Arrow Kids get pushed back at the last minute for any because they can't get all the parts manufactured. But I mean, other sources have reported. I mean, in the release, you know, Honda and Chevy both seemed very blush with the with IndyCar going to Arrow Kits, and I think bringing back a little bit of manufacturer competition, you know, I think that is going to be a good thing. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, you know, I mean, the Honda versus Chevy rivalry. I mean, right now, even heading into the off season, you know, Chevy picked up a bunch of Honda's top talent. You know, they got, you know, especially with, you know, they got Simon Pagenaud now. So and Honda, you know, they're trying to keep. I think they're trying to keep Justin Wilson. I mean, Justin Wilson was rumored to be looking to go over to KV Racing, but then Kurt Cavan from IndyStar reported that a potential Andretti deal is still on the table. So I'm not sure if that's true or not. But yeah, we'll just wait and see how it all shakes out. Chris, what are you looking forward to this year?
Kind of piggybacking the last thing you just said, where Justin Wilson goes is going to set the rest of the silly season dominoes. I'm looking forward to seeing how the new Arrow Kits affect the speeds over at the Speedway this year. Given that they wanted to try and do a new track record for 2016, I wonder how fast they're going to be this year compared to how they were in 2014. Of course, I'm also looking forward to seeing how the new schedule this year is going to compare to the one last year with, you know, different tracks being moved to different places and everything like that. And not to mention, of course, my favorite news that there's going to be a race in New Orleans here next year, seeing how they react to this track when it gets warmer, because they had a test over here a couple of weeks ago and it was downright frigid. I'm looking forward to seeing how the differences in the looks of the cars are going to increase, how it's going to affect competition, and I'm also looking forward to seeing how development of those Arrow Kits during the season affects competition as well. It's going to be interesting, that's for sure. And I'm looking forward to seeing what can happen if another Arrow Kit manufacturer comes in with something totally out of the box and just completely kicks everybody's teeth in. Adam?
Yeah, to me, super glad they're going to NOLA. Hopefully we can all come crash at your place. Check that out.
But, is there.
Justin Wilson, exactly. Justin Wilson would be a great final piece of the silly season. Pretty much the entire race in the silly season, as IndyCar is getting kind of a later start than most. He deserves a top ride. Hopefully Dale Coyne can give it to him if he's still at Dale Coyne, but if you were to jump up to Andretti or to go elsewhere, I would be very, very happy for the guy. Great guy. And let's not forget, he's one of the only people you can say has had experience in F1, in kart, in champ car, and in modern IndyCar. So a wealth of experience. The guy's kind of flown under the radar for most people, so that would be nice to see. Arrow Kids.
Hard for him to flow under the radar when he's the tallest person in the paddock.
Oh, gosh. At TMS, I walked up to him and Dale Coyne standing beside each other and talked to him for a few minutes out there before the start of the race. And I felt like a little kid talking to an adult. They were just, they're both so tall. It's crazy. And yes, he does look like Nicolas Cage. Maybe he could win a championship and Nicolas Cage can play him in a movie. It would be better than Gone in 60 Seconds, as far as I'm concerned. Actually, back in the day, I really wanted Mark Webber to win a Formula One championship. So Hugh Jackman could play him in a movie. But that's probably
I think Patrick Dempsey looks more like Mark Webber than Hugh Jackman.
Oh, well, Mark Webber would probably like, I don't know. And Patrick Dempsey has some experience racing, so. Anyway,
yeah, that's always a plus.
That's neither here or there. My mom always loves to hear when Patrick Dempsey's in the race. I was like, oh, Mom, Patrick Dempsey's on TV. Ooh, he's in a pop. But, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the Arrow Kits. I think it's going to be awesome. I hope the competition stays close, but the visual distinction is, I think, one of the final pieces of the puzzle IndyCar has been needing to really get their product in the public eye and show the world just how good it is. We've got about 15 minutes left, give or take, and I want to transition now to one of my favorite things of the year. That is very much upon us. A couple renders have been shown, but no true unveilings happen until Thursday and Friday and Saturday. Before the first test of the season this weekend, it is Formula One launch season, which for people like me is like Christmas. McLaren goes on Thursday, Ferrari's on Friday, Toro Rosso's on Saturday. You know, pretty much everyone else will be at the test. Lotus has shown a render. Williams has shown a render. The crazy noses are gone. They've been kind of lopped off a little bit. So, Chris, what are you looking forward to for F1? What do you think we'll see at the first test?
Mercedes is probably going to be at the top. I would love to see Ferrari do well, but given what they said before the season, I'm looking forward to seeing what they're going to do. Honestly, F1 has almost kind of lost its luster for me for the launches because a lot of the cars look very, very similar year upon year. But I remember, like, you know, in the early 2000s, you could see the noticeable differences in the cars from year to year. But nowadays, it just doesn't have the same kind of luster for me. But I do hope that we see some, you know, noticeable changes that we can say, oh, I know how – I can see how this car changed from last year to this year, you know, and stuff like that. I am looking forward to seeing, you know, of course, the different liveries, because, but then again, half of them are going to be, you know, black or in silver or something like that. But it will be interesting to see how the new car driver combinations interact with each other at the test session, the test coming up in a few weeks' time. Adam, you?
Yeah, I'm really, really curious to see. I think McLaren Honda will be a little bit behind. I think their first test will be a lot like everyone's first test last year. Most of the eyes are going to be on them, you know, particularly Alonso. After causing such a storm and a dust up at the end of last season, with everything going on, I think they'll be under a microscope. That'll be a new livery. Dauber's going to have a new livery. They're going to give us you a blue and yellow theme from Felipe Nasser's sponsor, Banco de Brasil. So that will literally and hopefully for Sauber figuratively brighten up the back of the grid. I think most eyes will probably be on Sebastian Vettel and that Ferrari, though. Ferrari's been very coy. They've been very, you know, they're not setting the bar that high. But you know they want to strike back. For me, it's all about, is Mercedes going to stay that far ahead? I think Williams is going to get a lot closer to him. Williams is going from strength to strength. I think Lotus is going to bounce back quite a lot with the Mercedes engine package now. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting season. I will totally echo your sentiment on the fact that there's not enough visual distinction in the cars. There were some different nose interpretations, but if you look from the front axle back, so many of them are so similar. And I think IndyCar can really distinguish itself this year by having more variety and more potentially visible aerodynamic development than Formula One, which, you know, if you'd have told me that a year or two ago, I'd have laughed and fallen out of my chair. Probably cried a little. But I'm curious to see what's going to happen. There's so much talk about changing the engines again, not this season, but the season after that or the season after that. What are you looking forward to, Josh?
Well, I'm looking forward to Fernando Alonso at McLaren. You know, I think Alonso, you know, Alonso is going to go down to the, or in his career, I think Alonso is going to go down as one of the all-time greats. But it's just, I think his second stint at McLaren, it's going to be, you know, I think it's going to be better than the first for a couple reasons. And one of them is, you know, I mean, Jensen, as good as he is, you know, I mean, he's, you know, he's getting old and his career's kind of ending. Is kind of, he's in the twilight of his career. While Alonso is still. Is still very much alive, and it's just, you know, his first stint at McLaren, you know, and ended in just absolute disaster. And, you know, we had a true Prost and Senna-esque rivalry between him and Lewis Hamilton, but then of course we had everything with Stephanie Gate, and then Alonso let it get ugly. When he threw his hat in the ring there, and that probably cost him big time. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to that, and I'm curious to see what, I mean, after Honda had a disastrous first test, I'm looking forward to seeing what rabbit they're going to pull out of their hat by the time we go green in Melbourne.
Yeah,
so
agree, and I'll do a semi-rebuttal on Alonso. He has to make this stint at McLaren go better, and that's very obvious. To me, this is a make-or-break point in Alonso's career. He can either go down as one of the all-time greats, or he can go down as a serial quitter. And by that, if you look back to Alonso's early days, he built up nicely with Renault after his single year at Minardi. And we're the only team, albeit helped quite a lot by the tire rules that Michelin interpreted better than Bridgestone. He helped topple Schumacher. He and Kimi were the guys of the future. And right at the peak of that back-to-back championship success, he jumps to McLaren, still does really well, still comes within a point of a title, but throws a fit, goes back to Renault, sits on the sidelines for a couple of years, gets a few wins here or there. Don't even get me started on Singapore 08 in that fiasco. Goes to Ferrari, never truly delivers on his promises, but as a PR master, makes everyone think it's more the team's fault than his. But to me, a true all-time great could have turned that around. A true all-time great would have done like Lauda did and turned that around, would have done like Schumacher did and turned that around. And I'm not saying Alonso is not great. He probably is the best on the grid right now in terms of his driving level. But in terms of his leadership, in terms of his, you know, true potential being achieved, I think he's fallen a little flat. So I think it would be really, really curious to see where he goes from here. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, in the nick of time, we have Mr. Joey Barnes, my Tribute Racing colleague. Joey, what are you looking forward to in F1? I know you pretty much share my thoughts on Alonso. So what else are you looking forward to these unveilings in his first test?
Well, first off, thanks for having me. Sorry for the delay. I'm having a hell of a time with the fun stuff here at the house and the internet and everything else kind of going out of whack. And unfortunately, I couldn't be with you boys earlier. But, actually, to talk a little bit about the Alonso thing, you know, the one striking point that nobody has really ever made that I've never heard that just kind of dawned on me is, what if he joined all these teams when the team was already a step behind the elite? You know, what if it was a situation where really he was on a C-plus or B-plus team? You know, you look at Ferrari when they won with Kimi and when they damn near won it with Massa. That was their peak, and it was all downhill from there. And really, you know, you look at McLaren and Red Bull, those were the teams to beat at that time, and especially with Red Bull. So, I don't know, I look at that and I kind of wonder, you know, I never think Alonso's great. I'm sorry, I know that's going to piss a lot of people off. Is he talented? Yes. Is he very raw? Yes. But, you know, maybe he was the guy that was just behind the eight ball and at the wrong team a little too late. So, I don't know. That's my brief thought. But when you're talking about looking ahead, The Lotus photos that I saw today really intrigued me with the wing design, with the nose plant, a lot different than last year. I believe they have a different power plant. They're going with Mercedes this year. Very interested to see what happens with Crashdoor, Maldonado and company, and seeing if they can really pull it together now that Boullier is officially, you know, he's been out for a year now, and this gives the, I don't know the team principal's name off the top of my head, but, you know, it gives him a full year that he's been with the team, a full year where it's his development going towards the team. And, you know, with all these new designs, they were the wild card team to challenge Red Bull and just a couple years ago with Grosjean and Kimi. And, you know, Grosjean showed that if you can give him a car that is at least on par so we just got done talking about Alonso being the the guy, but for so many teams that he's had the raw talent. But in some ways, Grosjean resembles that just in a younger form. So in some ways, it's kind of interesting to go from one to the other. I think that if you give Grosjean a car that's capable of producing podiums and top fives, he could get you that and maybe even a little bit more. So I don't know. When I'm looking ahead, I look at everything. I mean, Ferrari, Lotus, you know, obviously if Williams can back up what they've done from last year, and I look for more of the same out of Mercedes, but honestly, I'm hoping that Rosberg can get his balls back and take it to Hamilton. So, I don't know, that's just some of the things that I'm looking forward to whenever I'm looking at next season.
Yeah, you stole the words right out of my mouth on the Grosjean thing. I think it will be really exciting to see how he fights back if this new Lotus car comes good. We've got about 4 minutes. I just want to do a brief closing thought. Usually if there's a big race coming up, we say who we think is going to win or we give our top three or something. But I'm going to be kind of ballsy with this one. I want each of us to give who they think will finish in the top three in the constructor standings for F1 for this season. I'll go first. I think it will be Mercedes again. Then I think it will be Williams. And then I think it will be Ferrari, actually. Chris?
My closing thoughts. It's great to see the racing season get underway safely. Because last year, you know, we had that big accident with Mimo Gidley. It's great to hear his voice again. I'm looking forward to seeing what the next F1 cars will look like, of course. I mean, despite what I said earlier, I mean, it's still nice to see what the new ones look like. Looking forward to getting the rest of the racing season going underway with Daytona coming up here in a few weeks. I know Matt Weaver's having a good time over in Charlotte. And, of course, I'm also looking forward to next weekend, this weekend coming up, competing in the Daytona 24 Hours for iRacing. I'm just looking forward to all the different cool things right now. Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's always good to knock the dust off and, you know, get back to work again of getting out and actually going to cover a race. You know, I'm glad the Rolex 24 was a good one. And, honestly, I want Sebring to happen this upcoming weekend rather than us having to wait 2 months. But yeah, I mean, good to get the season underway and knock the dust off. Joey?
I think, with Adam, you talked about the constructors and whatnot. I think obviously Mercedes will be there. I think Williams is probably going to fumble a little bit, mostly with just the not being able to develop as good as the others as far as financially. I know that, yes, they've got this and that, but I'm Mercedes. I would probably say Ferrari, and then probably Red Bull, as much as I hate to say it. Not for Cavato, strictly for Ricciardo. So, but I guess closing thoughts, the Rick Abreu won the Chili Bowl, but as far as major forms of motorsports, it starts off with Scott Dixon winning. If that is a trend this year, it's going to be a really boring year. So, yeah, I hope that that's not the case. And, obviously it's exciting to have the racing season back. And, I honestly can't wait for it. More than anything, I can't wait for Speed Weeks in Daytona, and I can't wait for, IndyCar. So we'll see from there.
Well, amen to that. That brings the show to a close for this year. Penske strong, Joey, so I wouldn't worry too much about it being a Scott Dixon fest from here on.
They're going to implode. Ganassi's Ganassi. And Penske's going to implode.
We'll see. Hallelujah. Racing is back. Hope you guys all enjoyed the show. Hopefully we can see some of you guys at the various racetracks we'll be out this year. And Joey forgot to say it this time, so I'll say it for all of us. Forza Jules. Good night. I'm Adam Tate, Joey Barnes from Tribute Racing, Christopher DeHardy from Motorsport.com, and Josh Farmer from Motorsport Monday. Have a good evening, folks.